Welcome to BIO, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. BIO is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm BIO member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we'll talk with a biographer about his or her work. In this special episode, we feature the insights of celebrated historian, professor, and author David Levering Lewis. His latest book, The Stained Glass Window, A Family History as the American Story, 1790 to 1958, was published by Penguin Random House in February 2025. Lewis is a Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer, National Humanities Medal recipient, and a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant awardee. David Levering Lewis was interviewed by fellow biographer and BIO member John, better known as Jack, Farrell.
So David, tell us about Clarissa, your enslaved great-grandmother. She's not the woman of the title in the stained glass window. That was her daughter, Alice. But in many ways, as I read this book, it seemed that Clarissa, her story was the inspiration that drove you on to do the book. Who was she? How did she end up with property in Atlanta? And what did that mean for succeeding generations?
Well, I must tell you, I had never heard the name Clarissa. When I went to Atlanta after the loss of my wife of many years, just in a kind of meditative condition, I suppose you'd say. She, it turned out, when I finally made contact with the archivist at Roswell Historical Society, about 25 miles outside Atlanta, I discovered that she was, in fact, the linchpin to really much of my life. Who was she? She had grown up on the plantation of the Barrington Kings, one of the most successful plantation operations of the antebellum period. Successful because they milled their own wool and their own cotton, and so they avoided all the business of cotton factors charging them too much money to handle the sale of their product. He bought in 1822 a group of enslaved people from the Savannah merchants of the day, and Elsie and William were among those purchased, and they would become the putative ancestors of this Clarissa. She was born, presumably, by Elsie in 1835. Then Barrington moved to Roswell to succeed his father and brought these people with him. And so she grew up as a king, and she thought herself that, and she clung to that patronymic in slavery and in freedom. But who was she? Well, I made contact with the Roswell archivist, Elaine De Niro, and I spent a day there in Roswell, and she said, well, this has been interesting. I want to show you the history of this place, but I fear we have really no useful information about your quest. And so it was a very pleasant meeting. And I flew back to New York thinking that that had not been a very useful rendezvous. How wrong I was, though. Within less than a month came a certified packet of information from Elaine De Niro saying, Professor Lewis, I do think that I can be helpful after all. And she then photocopied the slave purchase of Clarissa's parents in 1822. And then she provided the bill of sale of this same Clarissa in 1852, when she was then 17 years old. And then she said, I think we can find where she is. And we did. We found her rematerializing in Houston County in the plantation of James Wiley Belden and his dear wife, Eliza Judith Rembert. And her sale took place just as the Belvins, having occupied formerly Cherokee territory, which had been expunged by Andrew Jackson by that time. They had moved from South Carolina into this gorgeous property and had brought with them a large number of enslaved people who would be the basis for their prosperity. And there she was, Clarissa, as housemaid for the Belvins. And then the story thickens and complicates, and it leads us to a relationship between James Wiley Belvin and this Clarissa, not acknowledged during the lifetime of slavery, but soon thereafter, when this Belvin comes to Atlanta, recovering from the damages inflicted by Sherman in 1875, even then it's still recovering, and he purchases a house on what will become Auburn Avenue from one Moses Frank. And what was so interesting about Moses Frank, I discovered soon, he was the uncle of Leo Frank, the Jewish gentleman who ran a pencil factory and who was misidentified and crucified for the charge of raping one of his white employees. And that anti-Semitic uprising and moment in American history, we have all regarded as quite significant. Well, Moses Frank sold the property for pittance to Clarissa. He acknowledged that they had had this parallel affection and life together. And so she then became the owner of this Victorian mansion offset from what becomes Auburn Avenue. But what was interesting about the relationship between them was that in his final will, just at the end, is written, "We must not forget Clarissy." And it's the first mention of her in any significant documents to do with the Belvins. But now we see the coming into Atlanta, the exchange of property, an indenture. However, that indenture had a reversionary clause in it, and that if Clarissa did not have issue, or if any of her issues were to die, then the property would revert to the Belvins. 1 year later, there was a second indenture, which gave in perpetuity property of great value to Clarissa and to her daughter, who was, of course, also James Wiley Belvin's last issue, born in 1872 and therefore in freedom. And that was the basis for a degree of affluence that my Bell family was advantaged by. Finally, I could see that I could tell a story. Both of the kings and the Belvins, as whites related to me in some sense, and then the mulatto strain going all the way back to the first census of 1790 of the Republic, where there was a Martha Jemima Bell, whose descendants would prosper in the shadows, as it were, of this three-tier arrangement in South Carolina until they too would migrate to Atlanta, and their Belvins and Bells would, in a sense, coalesce. And the assumption was that, as my mother insisted, we were descended from the kings, of Roswell. That finally drove me to use the services of a very excellent geneticist. Through the Trees was the name of his organization. And I said to Mr. Christmas, interestingly enough, named Mr. Christmas, "Tell me, is there a genetic connection between me and the kings, as my mother believed? And secondly, is there any connection with the Belvins?" He came back about 2 weeks later and he said, "Well, no, that doesn't mean that there isn't a connection, but we cannot claim that it shows up." And so I thought, well, evidence of absence is not absence of evidence, as my mother might have said. But he said, I have a surprise for you. You are a direct descendant of James Wiley Belden, not as you believed, his son, who you thought, because of the unlikelihood that there would be a relationship between the housemaid in the presence of dear James Wiley Belden's wife for so many years, that it must be the Randy son, the heir of the usufruct of the cotton growing, and incidentally, a rather impressive war record veteran of the Civil War. And so then we would have the kings with the belief that a possible putative connection, the Belvins direct, and then we would have the mulatto strain, and then we would have the Lewises finally. And so you could talk about the whole business of race as it changed in intensity and in configuration down through the decades.
All in one great book. So it reminded me of Sally Hemings, and I was wondering if you speculated as to what mix of emotions, whether it was shame or guilt or affection, would lead the White family to feel concerned enough to want to give Clarissa this property.
I think there was just that admixture of guilt, of compensation. I don't rule out an element of affection, however. You can see it in a number of relationships, which are both an embarrassment to both parties as we go forward. The fact that Belvin will pay for the education of his daughter, and Alice King, temporarily, she obliged Major Belvin by calling herself Alice Lee Belvin King. As soon as she felt secure, there was never again a reference to Lee Belvin. However, in her education, both primary and secondary at Atlanta University, it's clear that Major Belvin paid the tuition. And so you might also hypothetically say that there was an element of affection, of concern, of investment, at least, in her success.
There seems to have been a feeling 10 or 20 years ago, maybe longer ago than that, that it was useless to try to do this kind of research, that Alex Haley was a one shot and that the records just were not there. One of the things that's stunning about your book is the ability of looking in so many different places, and especially when you get on later to the Reconstruction period, where a Northern minister taking down the words of the former slaves who were being persecuted for supporting Ulysses Grant, and those letters were going to the white supremacists, and yet they survive and give us this great picture of the white supremacist Knight Riders and what they did to the free
Yes,
black.
indeed.
There was a tremendous amount of stuff. You must, as a historian, must have just been like chortling and saying, "My God, this can be done."
Well, it can be done, but it can be done with luck. Indeed, it does take a village. He was, in fact, the president of Columbia College, I think, in Kentucky, the gentleman who, before the war, had delivered Bibles to the plantation houses. And he returned after Appomattox, and he was stunned by the changed relationship. Whereas, because of the cash value of the enslaved people, their treatment was humane in the sense that procreation and sale of them gave cash value to them. After the war, we have a different class relationship of poor whites who had been the servants of the master class as patrollers, as workers, and what have you, who felt no affectation, no affection at all for the former enslaved. And he witnessed this as people tried in 1868 As Reconstruction began to piece itself together with Thaddeus Stevens and Charles Sumner in the North, they would be able to vote for a presidential election. And the attempt to do that was, for the most part, forlorn and prevented and indeed punished quite severely. But this former president of Columbia College, taking down the voices of the enslaved formerly, now determined to share the 14th and 15th Amendment values, would take this document finally and give it to Charles Sumner, and it would indeed delay the readmission of Georgia into the Union. Indeed, General Grant, as is well known, appointed an attorney general who was a former Confederate, who therefore knew the business of punishment of the new Klan and did so relatively effectively. And so we have voices of the enslaved, which were so rare in those days. Not all of the enslaved had been denied literacy, but the percentages, of course, were always quite minimal. And so this was a moment in the whole story of Reconstruction history that was quite valuable.
So we've got, Clarissa, a freed slave after the war, the Smiths, who are freed slaves after the war, but you also have a strain in the family, the Bell family of South Carolina, who were of that fascinating little known segment of the American population, freed blacks at the time of the Revolution and immediately thereafter.
Yeah.
One of the that you do so well in the book is take the personal story and mix it with the American story. And the three or four pages where you talk about how the fledgling abolition movement during the Revolution and in the constitutional period seemed to be getting some traction, only to be crushed by the demands of King Cotton, both in North and South. Is it a second great lost opportunity?
Yes.
With Reconstruction? Money always seems to win out in the end.
That is true. And so I do something that may be highly speculative. I want to pause when I go to the chapter setting up slavery with the overseers who are going to perfect their management, the kings, who will take service with this curious British officer who, having served His Majesty in Canada, defeating the French, is on his way back to his barracks in England. But he takes his time. He's actually looking for a wealthy woman. And he knows that in South Carolina, there are lots of Bells who have lots of money and lots of enslaved people. And he goes there and he pretends to be of some noble pedigree. He impresses the Lawrences and the other important people thereby, marries that woman, and then decides, I think I know who's going to win in this confrontation. So he takes off his uniform and he buys property and he joins the American Revolution. And he will show up, of course, in the 1789 Constitutional Convention. And he will be obsessed with one issue, though. He lost a lot of slaves when the British marched into South Carolina and occupied Charleston. And many of the enslaved decided to depart with the British after the Treaty of Paris, which ended the Revolution. And he's furious of this loss. And so he inserts into Article 4, I believe, of the new Constitution, a statement that reciprocity was an obligation to return people who were guilty of various things, even during the Articles of Confederation. Well, he amended it to say that any crime should result in this reciprocity, this return from one state or one colony to another of people who had offended things. And so it is really the first fugitive slave clause in our Constitution. And his nephew, who will inherit His great success with cotton and rice in Carolina and Georgia will also continue the management of many, many people. And the story there is interesting because miscegenation seemed to be embedded in the affairs of the kings as they oversaw the vast plantation wealth of the Butlers. The mulattoes who become free, or were free as a result of just a slight, how shall I put it? Someone said, Samuel Johnson said something about, we hear the loudest yelps for freedom from drivers of Negroes in America. What's that all about? And so that paradox, which Du Bois wrote about so well in his Harvard dissertation, there might have been a different evolution in what we have to deal with. And it might have been in 1803 when, as a bargain sale, Thomas Jefferson, then president, allowed his representative to accept Napoleon Bonaparte's remarkable fire sale offer of a mere $15 million for 533,000 virgin acres of the new United States, which changes everything. And we forget that the North was so concerned about this that there was a secessionist movement led by Alexander Hamilton and others, because, of course, it would mean that the Mississippi would now be the artery of so much of the new acquired property. And also, Jefferson, though, had to justify what he'd done. There's no constitutional, no legal empowerment that he could have done that. But he said, this is to be the empire of liberty for the yeomanry, the white yeomanry, who will not be ensnared by banks and troubles. They will be independent, and they will sail forth and develop all of this acreage. Of course, there were no yeomanry in large numbers there. The entire expanse will be ceded to slaveholders. And there, Thomas Jefferson has an obligation that he himself realized famously in a letter to John Holmes, one of a fellow slaveholder, when he said something like, we have the wolf by the ears, and we cannot let him go. And yet, justice is in one way, and selfishness is in another. And so money indeed prevailed.
Yeah, and of course, it's another great tragic irony that one of the reasons that Napoleon wanted to get rid of his New World holdings was that there had been a successful slave revolt against the French.
Indeed, in Haiti.
So one more tragic irony, just when we're reading in your story about the courageous work of those escaping or leaving bondage, we come to the Bell family of South Carolina, who are freed blacks. And there's this stunning moment in your book where you acknowledge that they were probably slave owners themselves. Did you actually sit there for a second at the keyboard and say, boy, if I put this in, it's going to wreck the simple narrative and go for the true complexity of history? And then did, like, the little imp of history on your shoulder say, no, you have to go with this, David, you have to go with it?
Yeah, it was the imp on the shoulder, John. But I had a student, Larry Koger, who has written about black slaveholders, and it's a true read of what happened. Carter Woodson, for example, was confronted by this dilemma of black slaveholders, and he did say that it was really people who were related to each other, and therefore it was rather a kinder way of householding them. Well, Koger found no, that was not true. And even John Hope Franklin, who accepted Carter Woodson's analysis, but later thought that perhaps you had to admit that the commerce in slave bodies was biracial. My Bells, though, were too poor ever to own the enslaved. And what happened was that Martha Jemima, she, by 1820, is managing enslaved persons who are growing rice in Four Hole Swamp, which was a particularly prodigious rice area. And she was quite happy managing her plantation. There's a very fine two-volume history of Goose Creek by a man named Heitzler. And there you find that he scratched his head when he came across these women who were managing rice plantations. Who were they? Well, starting with the Ball family moving into Charleston, the richness of the land had degraded considerably. And so they had, for the most part, deserted their holdings in St. Peter's Parish and gone to Charleston. But the value of the property still was considerable. We find that Isaac Bradwell, and there I had an echo. If I had never heard the name of Clarissa mentioned by my mother, I had succeeded in getting her to mention something about Martha Jemima and an Isaac Bradwell. And sure enough, I found him moving into Four Hole Swamp. And soon there are children. And soon he will be there for 10 years. He lost his first legitimate wife and moved into Four Hole Swamp to be with Martha Jemima. And then it seems he had a second wife and left. But then he came back when she died. And we have now four males and one daughter from Isaac Bradwell. And there I had a little bit of a twinge about Isaac Bradwell, because he was a secessionist who was the ally of John C. Calhoun. He protested the tariffs imposed by the North upon the South. He was head of a committee of security, lest any abolitionist literature ever find its way into South Carolina. He was really determined to defend the rights of South Carolina. However, these were his issue, and it may well be that he enabled them to leave South Carolina and go to Atlanta. Why they would do that? For two reasons. The class conflict in South Carolina was a Marxian revelation, really, because the masters were conflicted about acknowledging the complaints of the poor white craftsmen, because every slave who was given latitude to work for others shared his profit with the master. And so when the people upcountry, South Carolina, began to pull themselves together politically, by 1855, they had had a governor who was sympathetic to the rising white craftsmen, who wanted to break the monopoly in Charleston of the mulatto and free African Americans, who did everything. John Lawrence, who had made his fortune in the transatlantic slave trade, said, "Today you go to Charleston, and what do you find? Every occupation is monopolized by these people to the detriment of our own flesh and blood." However, by 1860, for the first time, there was a legislation to re-enslave these people in order to break the monopoly they had. And that monopoly was participated in, of course, by these Bells. They were carpenters, they were firemen, plumbers, and other things. But they didn't want to hang around once Appomattox happened, because the enslaved now would want that monopoly broken as well. And so they migrate safely to Atlanta, which is the go-ahead place for people who don't have much but have a lot of gumption behind them.
The complexity of history is amazing, and to keep it in track like you did is terrific. So now we move up to the 20th century and the civil rights generations before and after the war. And your family is in Atlanta and Little Rock, and they are dealing with Thurgood Marshall. You are introduced as a young boy to W.E.B. Du Bois. I guess the family is in the talented 10th, am I correct?
Yes, I think so. My father was always a little queasy about that because there was a lot of pedigree nonsense about the Talented Tenth. And he was a good old guy who got ahead thanks to the fact that his sisters saved their shekels and paid for his education. But he had none of the pretensions of the woman he married as the second wife, my mother.
But your family seems to have taken education as well as politics as sort of the specialty.
I think that's true. My meeting of my father and Thurgood Marshall was one such example of that. So when the Rockefellers and the Rosenwalds decided it was time to have a new look at secondary education for African Americans, it was decided that one special school would be built in various places, and Dunbar High School was such a school. There was a confrontation there about whether or not it would follow the Booker Washington vocational model or be more collegiate. And as it turned out, the choice was a collegiate high school, one of the best, I suppose, in the South. And my father became its principal in 1930. However, by 1940, after Pearl Harbor, the teachers at Dunbar noticed the discrepancy under Plessy versus Ferguson, the great Supreme Court decision of separate but equal. They decided things were not equal at all, and they wanted to protest. And the exchange is rather interesting. Walter White, head of the NAACP, then thought that the branch of the NAACP in Little Rock was pretty phlegmatic, and he wanted some successes elsewhere. But these teachers filed suit in federal court, and the young Thurgood Marshall then said, gosh, these guys have backbone now. I'd better go and see what they're after. And from that came a suit for equal pay for equal work. And my father, as a Yale man and as a University of Chicago man, testifying on behalf of the plaintiffs and at the direction of Thurgood Marshall, sacrificed himself for a cause which soon would prevail by the Eighth Circuit Court, which would review the decision of the federal judge in Little Rock and say, indeed, these people have every claim to their cause. And so we then had to leave, and we moved to the north to Wilberforce. And I suppose my growing up really took place in Wilberforce. And so outside the restrictions that had befallen the South as a result of Booker Washington's compromise speech, the 1896 Plessy Ferguson decision, and then finally the terrible 1906 pogrom in Atlanta, when finally the White South eliminated all presence of African Americans as voters, with some symbolic remains of people in order to be compliant with the 15th Amendment.
What did you mean when you said your father sacrificed himself by testifying?
Yes, I'm sure Marshall, given the correspondence between them after the litigation, I must have said to him, we realize that if you defend your teachers, you will be confronted with the Board of Education, which will fire you. And that is exactly what happened. And so he anticipated the inevitable by resigning himself after the decision.
And there's a very sad story at the end of the book of you and your dad driving to see the christening of a school named in his honor. And you tell the story rather than me.
Yes, I was a bit slow because I opened the book, I think, early on with a trip south to a place called Schley County, which I'd never heard of, with my father, who had informed me and my mother that he had now the dubious distinction of having a high school in a place alien to us. named after him. And we drove down, and I detected an uncomfortableness and impatience on the part of my father, which I couldn't make sense of. I thought it was a really impressive structure. And I thought that the reception, which was a bit curious, when we arrived, a line of whites on one side and a line of African Americans on the other welcomed us. And as we walked to the platform, the whites said, "Good show, John, you've done us proud." And the African American said, "Oh, we're so pleased to see you." And he then spoke, and we investigated the library and the other facilities, and we left. But driving back, I asked my father, I said, "Why are we here, Dad? How did you come from this place?" And he said, "Well, I'll tell you." And he became very confessional with me to say that his sisters, Susie and Maisie, had put aside their lives in order to raise money, and his mother as well. The three people sacrificed for their education, my father's education at Yale and my medical officer brother, uncle's education at Howard. And I thought, well, that was interesting. And so I said, well, of course, I'm leaving. Well, then I end the story with realizing why he was impatient, as I talk about Eisenhower, that the South had, in its reaction to Brown versus Board, built equity schools right, left, and center everywhere. Equity schools were schools that were to say, we're not going to integrate, but we'll give you the best that you should have. And that explained my father's annoyance. And so there we were in Atlanta, where my father had returned in 1950 to be president of one of the Atlanta University colleges. Eisenhower is president, and Brown is declared in 54, and then with the enforcement decision in 55 of all deliberate speed. And what all deliberate speed meant was, because of Eisenhower's attitude, which was, as Richard Kluger has judged, the historian of Brown versus Board, Eisenhower had indulged the White South and the Southern Manifesto and all of that business. So they saw that nothing was going to happen that would make a great difference, even though as members of a privileged group, they saw also the reasons why there was some schizophrenia, as it were, that we had established institutions, banks, and schools, and other profit-making endeavors. And integration could mean that we were sucked into and co-opted by the natural consequences of a successful integration. And so there was, as Kluger said, there was no dancing on the tables in Harlem after 1954. Well, they, as members of that, were quite impatient. And Atlanta was particularly emblematic of resistance to change, because there was such affluent success on the part of those who were affluent and successful. And so even when Martin Luther King was to move from Montgomery to Atlanta, there was a crisis between the two power structures. We don't want Martin Luther King to do what he did in Montgomery. He got people up and marching and that sort of thing. The Atlanta way, as some have said, was one of moderation, complementarity, and of wealth. And indeed, when the editor of Fortune magazine came to look at what was going on in Atlanta, he wrote an interesting study in which he said, unsegregated dollars is the success story of Atlanta. We don't need Supreme Court decisions. We don't need a federal enforcement. We don't need fundamental change. Let the dollar work its way. Well, my father said a dollar isn't going to work its way down far enough. And his impatience was reflected in that congratulatory letter he sent to Du Bois for his 90th birthday, in which he complimented Du Bois even after the shock of many years earlier, being present when Du Bois reviled the talented 10th for its failure to follow it, the charge that he had given it. And he, Du Bois, had said, you have to read Karl Marx, which they thought, since everybody was going to HUAC in those days to say that he or she was not a communist, was quite inappropriate. But now he could see the wisdom of that old guy.
Now you go over to study in London at the School of Economics.
Yeah.
And you're saying goodbye to your family. And your dad says to you, wait until you can be useful. What did he mean by that?
I think he hoped that when I finished my education, I would be a citizen who would be informed in many ways about the tricky business of social progress, and that I would write something or vote the right way. And you, in fact, in your very good questions, the ninth one, I think you say, what would we do today when so much of the success of John Lewis and of Martin King and of so many citizens who now had reached the point where diversity, equity, and inclusion was a concept worth respecting, now has been rejected by a curiously backward, and it's hard to see how the present arrangement since November will be a benefit even to the people who voted for the incumbent president. And it may well be that the calamity of what he hopes to achieve will be a sanitizing and sobering aftermath to get us back on track. But to lose the world we built after 1945, the EU and NATO, in one fell swoop, in order to enable the adventurisms of a kleptomaniac Russian, seems curious.
And not to mention what years of progress at
No.
home are being threatened. So I've always thought that one of the greatest blessings America ever had is the patience of its black population.
Yes.
Tell me, how do we persevere in the next 4 years?
Yes. My daughter and I were in the Bahamas, and I was flying back to New York and she to Washington, and she discovered that she couldn't return because Reagan Airport had its meltdown. And then to hear the president ascribe the calamity to DEI, I thought was something that no president, to my knowledge, has ever said. That was to wipe out everything that we thought achieved. And so patience is with us again. I think, though, this time we may have more allies than we have had in the past.
What is the moral of the stained glass window?
There are several, but one is that because of the spectacular success that was reversed perhaps by Reagan of the student movement and all that ensued, we have the impression that the Reconstruction fizzled out, and then there was this sad period of marginalization and ineffectiveness. And you find that, as you were suggesting, not only the patience of African Americans, but the success of so many of us was illustrative of a determination to hold on to the values enshrined at the beginning and to show that success on the battlefield and domestically and economically was very much the story of that period that one historian, Rayford Logan, described as the nadir. The nadir indeed, but in that nadir there were institutions that throve, there were lives that advanced, and there were contributions that were made that finally brought us to the precipice of collectivity which always we don't quite get to.
Thank you so much, David. I've kept you for a long time, but I think the book is certainly worth it, and the people that we meet in the book add to the richness of my life. Thanks for a great book.
Thank you, John.
That was Pulitzer Prize winning author and scholar David Levering Lewis, speaking with Jack Farrell about his latest book, The Stained Glass Window, A Family History as the American Story, 1790 to 1958. It was published by Penguin Random House in February of this year, and this interview was recorded via Zoom on March 4th, 2025. To learn more about Bio, or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Darren Neblett created our theme music. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.